Blog Talk Radio.
Jerry, the big movie story, certainly of this month, possibly of this year, is Paranormal Activity. Wouldn't you say?
I mean, it's astounding the success this film has had.
Did you get a sense of this movie prior to about a month ago or so?
No. I didn't even know about this movie until that campaign started, and we saw like on Facebook and MySpace that they're getting the numbers. I didn't even know about this film until the middle of September, I would say, at the earliest.
Yeah, I suppose the people that attended the various festivals, I know it premiered at Scream Fest, went to Slam Dance, you know, they got a sense of it, and there were some rumblings on certain websites about
right.
it. But now the world knows about it, and it seems like a very sudden phenomenon. This is the movie everyone has to see.
Yeah, it has that vibe. I mean, you couldn't ask for better marketing. You just couldn't ask for... I mean, this is just really the incredible the story. I would add, definitely for the second half of this year, I would say this is the story.
Or until anybody sees all of Avatar.
Yeah, I mean that's the other story, but I would honestly.
And that's on the other end of the spectrum, because Avatar, you know, one of the most ambitious, expensive films ever made. This is one of the cheapest films to hit the mainstream ever in the history of the medium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about story. It's all about suspense and the technique behind it and the. The effectiveness of it.
It is effective, and it's ironic. And I said this about Cloverfield and the Blair Witch Project much earlier. Is even though these films, like you know, you're basically watching camcorder footage. You know, they have to really be seen in a theater to get the full effect. They really do. All these films are that they're that kind. They have that kind of effectiveness to them. They're really generally scary. So.
And let's talk about the marketing, because this film has a lot in common with Blair Witch, of which the writer-director who we're about to bring on clearly acknowledges.
Yeah.
But in one respect, Blair Witch, as we've spoken to many times on the show,
started
the whole trend of the internet being a major device for promoting your film up to the masses.
Yeah, they have to really take advantage of the net. I mean, really use it to its full potential.
And Paramount has done a bang-up job with the marketing of this film.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
On top of the film itself, I mean, that's a story of the year right there.
Mm-hmm.
The trailer is brilliant.
Yes, it is.
Focusing so specifically on the audience reaction to watching the film.
Yeah.
You got to see it. If you're inclined to watch a scary film, you're going to be there.
That's right.
Yeah, so we have the writer-director on the show tonight. His name is Oren Peli, and we had a chance to speak to him about the film, and he's on another planet right now. I mean,
I can imagine.
I'm sure he's a little shell-shocked, because just, you know, not so long ago, he made this thing, and he thought, well, I guess that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody like Steven Spielberg gets a hold of it, and says, you know, you need to release this. You need to release this now.
Right.
And his life changes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty amazing stuff. Here is Oren talking to us about Paranormal Activity, which opens wide this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
high-def camera on. My girlfriend, Katie, she thinks there's something in the house. I don't know.
You believe me, right?
I think we're going to have a very interesting time capturing whatever paranormal phenomena is occurring or is not occurring.
Windows unlocked, doors unlocked, alarm is on.
I feel it breathing on me.
Footsteps in, but there's no footsteps out.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
If you do try to play games with it, that's inviting it in.
We're both crazy about this movie, and I cannot imagine how it feels for you already having achieved such success with it, and you're about to receive a lot more with this wide release on Friday. How does this feel? It has to be overwhelming for you.
It's beyond overwhelming. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, I can imagine. But you've come from, if I read correctly, the software business prior to making this movie. But had movies always been a dream for you? Had directing been a goal for you all along?
Well, I mean, I always, you know, everyone loves movies, but I really loved movies, and I was like a total movie geek, and I loved watching movies, and I loved watching them and kind of trying to analyze how they're made and what I could have done better or different. And I always dreamed about doing something to do with movies, but I didn't think I would have the time or the patience to go through the regular route of going to film school and working your way up. But after movies like Blair Witch and Open Water came out and showed that there's another way to do it, just buy a video camera and start shooting, and if it turns out well enough, then maybe you can sort of like bypass the whole system, and I figured, well, why not give it a shot?
Well, you did that. I see Open Water, I see Blair Witch in there, I see a lot of things in there, actually, Cloverfield and Cannibal Holocaust as well, the way it's shot. I saw this on Saturday, and I got to tell you something, Oren, the second half of the movie is some of the scariest stuff I've seen.
Cool.
And I got to tell you, the audience, you had some people just like jumping out of their seats.
Cool.
Myself included, I always say, oh, nothing scares me. A couple of moments, especially the movement of a certain blanket in one scene, you got a lot of scares out of that.
This is what fascinates me, though, because when you're working on a movie, can you tell as you're making it that it's working?
When you're making it, I mean, you have to some degree, trust your intuition and your instincts and to think, you know, if that turns out well, that could be really creepy and effective. But you don't really know until you have the whole thing edited together and you show it to, you know, to friends or test audiences. Until then, you know, you may think you know, but you need to have the people's confirmation.
Yeah. And when was that first screening where you knew that you had gold?
Well, I did a lot of screenings of really, really early cuts that weren't even finished, and I could see that there was probably something there. And then when the movie was coming together, I did a screening at my friend's Alex house with people that I didn't know, because you always want to have people that are, you know, more objective, not just friends. And there was a couple that was watching the movie, and the guy was like this big, you know, football-built type of guy. And during the whole movie, he was like holding on to his girlfriend going like, oh, shit, oh, shit.
Yeah, so, no, it's that kind of movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's an oh-shit movie.
Yeah, so that's when I started suspecting. And, you know, I had a lot of people telling me earlier on, you know, this is the scariest movie I've ever seen. And I'm not sure, maybe they're like just trying to be nice and, you know.
No, we're not trying to be nice. No, and if I can ask, this is based on a true story?
No, I'm not aware of any I could say it's inspired by me thinking about the concept of using a video camera. It's
right.
Nice. Because there were, like, you know, weird things happening in my house. So I thought I didn't actually go ahead and set up a video camera, but I thought if someone did set up a video camera and it's caught some bizarre stuff happening at night while people are asleep, they're not even aware of it, that's pretty damn creepy.
Right.
Yeah.
It is. Very creepy.
Now, I know that Blair Witch was one of the films that inspired you to embark on this, and we've talked to the Blair Witch guys, and they're fantastic. But their movie was met with tremendous success at the beginning, and then there seemed to be, and they admitted to this, a kind of backlash about the kind of gimmick behind it. Were you worried about too much emphasis being placed on the gimmick of the video camera and the
well,
static nature?
I mean, there's nothing I could do about whether or not I'm worried about it or not. That's what the movie is, and, you know, most people seem to really embrace it. I mean, it's really only because of the fans that the movie is where it is now. If
right.
it weren't for them liking the movie and demanding it and basically forcing the studio to keep expanding it, we wouldn't even be talking now.
Right.
So
right.
I think that's the premise of the movie, and it is what it is, and a lot of people love it, and a few people may not dig it, but what can you do?
Well, I love it, and I think the gimmick is a really a horrible term for it. It's what the
yeah,
film
I'm
is.
I'm not really considering it a gimmick. It's just a different
right.
way of telling a story.
But even so, I know that there was talk of a possible remake, and then they decided that nothing at all was wrong with the original, so why remake it? But do you think this film would have been as effective with a bigger budget and bigger kind of name actors?
It's hard to tell, and there was no specific decision about, you know, whether it's going to be name actors or not. I think it's just that the studio really loved the movie and they wanted to do something with it. But, you know, you can imagine that they would be really nervous about committing to releasing a movie, and how do you market a movie that basically
mm-hmm.
looks like, you know, cheap home video. And so for a while we weren't really sure what was going to happen until we did a test screening, and the executives were in the theater with, you know, just real recruited audience, and when they saw how well the original film plays, then they decided pretty much on the spot, you know what, let's just forget the whole remake thing.
yeah. And this movie is incredibly suspenseful. I mean, it's what your imagination fills in more than anything else. As a filmmaker, how do you achieve that?
To me, as a viewer, I always found that the anticipation is what's, you know, is worse than actually something happening. Like, you know, waiting to get the Novocaine shot at the dentist, that's worse than the actual shot.
Right.
So I know, like, that to me in a movie, just waiting for something to happen is the worst thing. And if it doesn't happen, if you expect something to happen and it doesn't happen when you expect it or at the same time or the right thing, then your anxiety just keeps building and building and building. And that's what a lot of people find to be kind of intolerable in the movie. That in,
yeah.
there are many sequences when you don't get the jump scare
right.
release of adrenaline, and you just have to keep taking it into the next night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know you've probably been asked about this nonstop since it came out. But obviously, Mr. Spielberg was a big fan of your film and has really shepherded the process of getting it out there. What have your conversations with Mr. Spielberg been like? That must be a dream for you.
Yeah, I haven't had any direct contact with him, but I did hear that he saw the movie and was terrified by it and really loved it, and that was one of the reasons that the whole remake idea was forgotten, because he just said, you know what, let's just release this one, because
yeah.
it was
yeah.
very effective on him.
Yeah, and have you attended screenings of the film since it's been in release?
Yeah, I snuck into a few theaters here and there.
and the response has been exactly what you had hoped for, I would imagine?
Yeah, it's always played very well, and it's extremely rewarding to see how, you know, people enjoy the movie and laugh at the right times and scream at the right times and, you know, moan and groan when, you know, things get too stressful. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You've done something really impossible here. We had interviewed the director of the Saw 6. I think you may have taken some of the thunder away from the latest Saw release.
Yeah,
oh,
you are aware of that.
At this point, I don't even know which movies are being released or what. So
no, but you've done something that no one else has been able to do. I mean, everything is around you, my friend. The buzz is all about you right now.
This is the story of the year, Ben. Yeah.
Okay, if you guys say so.
No, it is. Trust me, it is.
I want to know, you. I know that you're working on another film right now called Area 51, and when you look at what kind of career you'd like to have as a filmmaker, how would you define that? What challenges or goals do you want to take on going forward?
I would say probably to you know, try to bring something fresh and new that people will think, you know, they will enjoy the movie and they'll enjoy the story and the characters, but maybe see it in a different way. And to be, you know, innovative in many ways, and just keep, you know, making sure that people enjoy the movie for whatever reason it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, Warren.
Yeah.
This is a big success story, and we're so proud of you and happy for you.
Yes, we are.
Oh, thank you so much. You guys are too kind.
Thank you, Oren. Take care
now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Looks like something bit you.
Not the house. It's me.
You cannot run from this. It will follow you.
I'm in control.
You're not in control. What's happening to me?
They left a message.
It's not a ghost. What is it?
Film is Paranormal Activity. The writer-director is Oren Peli, who you just heard from. It opens this Friday. That really surprised me, and I told this to you. It surprised me that he hasn't spoken to Spielberg yet. It was shocking to me.
Yeah, well, I think that's going to change. I think that will change.
But Spielberg even suggested that he change the ending to his movie, and so that was odd.
Yeah.
But you saw it last weekend. We talked about it last show a little bit, but so the audience that you saw it with, what was the reaction?
They were really, you know, the reaction is generally positive. People were generally frightened. I mean, the second half of the film, and you're waiting also for something to happen. Whenever, you know, they go to sleep, you all, you know, it's, how shall I say it? It's like, it's very interesting. There's a very obvious homage to the Amityville Horror in the sense that everything starts taking place at 3:15 in the morning. When you're looking at the readout in the camcorder, which I always find interesting. It's just really, you know, like we were talking about the sound and everything, like we were talking about with the guy, the director of the Saw 6, who did the Strangers. And, you know, its sound is a very important element in this movie as well. And it's freaky. It is very freaky. And it's just very well done. And it's not a gimmick movie. It's really not. It's more than that. If it was a gimmick movie, I don't think it would have this kind of... this kind of a reaction. If it was just gimmick, it is actually, there is something there.
Well, I'm not sure because I don't think Blair Witch is a gimmick movie.
No, I don't think. Yeah, I don't think.
But that charge is placed against Blair Witch. So
when we get to talk about Blair Witch, the only movie like that I think before, and if people in the chat room want to correct me, they can. I'm going under the impression that Cannibal Holocaust is the first of all these kind of films. I'm going on that assumption. And when it goes with Blair Witch, is Blair Witch broke rules. If you're going to make a good movie or write a great book or do anything great, you got to break rules. If you don't break rules, nothing great is going to happen. You have to break rules. And it's the most important thing you can do on a daily basis is break rules. And the more you break, the better off you're going to be. And that's what these guys did with this movie, Paranormal Activity. I can't stress that enough. You don't listen to Robert McKay every time when you go write a script. That's why. This is what I don't understand about screenwriting books. They teach you how to write formula. That's why everything is so formulaic most of the time. So you got to break rules. That's the most important thing I've learned.
Yeah, I mean, they teach you how to be a working screenwriter.
They teach you how to be a working screenwriter, and, you know, that's good and everything that's starting out, but if you really want to get somewhere, you're going to have to play around with that formula and bend it to your advantage.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so but what interests me about the movie, as effective as it is now, is how it will be received years from now.
That's the total. You know that.
I mean, that was the basis. That was the basis of my question about the gimmick.
Now that's interesting. Is it just something? Is it a product of? You know, the next couple of weeks, or is it the product of the next couple of years? That's not just something with this movie. That's with a lot of movies that we like. How will it hold up?
But also, I mean, I was talking to Chris last night, and Chris, fellow movie geek Chris, will be joining us on Sunday's show. But we talked about it. He said he saw the reviews from A.O. Scott and the Michael Phillips.
Yeah, they didn't like it at the time. They hated it.
Also said Mike, almost said Michael Phelps.
Yeah, Michael Phelps, reviewer, swimmer, gold medalist,
But A.O. Scott said, I get it. It's very effective with an audience. I don't think he said, I don't think it'll be half as effective when you're watching it on DVD at home without the contagious reaction of an audience.
That's very true, I think. And I just read someone talking about Drag Me to Hell, a film that I like a lot, and Chris Roy liked a lot. And you have to really see that one in the theater as well, because people are watching at home, and it's not nearly as much fun as the theater-going experience, the audience. And there is something to be said for that.
But I find the same thing with comedies. A lot of comedies, I remember the first time I watched The Birdcage, I watched it by myself, I screened it. I thought it was fine, but then I watched it the next night with a full audience, and it was just it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
If there's something about those audience, that communal experience that automatically enhances the film.
Oh, that's very true. Look at, like, this summer's The Hangover. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It's contagious, and it's why I say, you know, and I disagree with one of my favorite interviews we had with Paul Schrader, but I don't think if the movie-going experience dies, the theater, then we're in big trouble, because that is, like, I think 90% of a great movie is the audience reaction, whether it's a comedy or a horror film or whatever genre. It's that audience reaction is so important. And if that goes, then a lot goes with it. So I think that I understand what A.O. Scott's saying. He's absolutely right. I don't know. Like, if I watched this at home a couple of years ago, I might not get the same feeling. That's very true.
Right. Okay, so if you missed any part of the interview with Oren, you can replay it. It'll be available for replay about half an hour after the show ends, and you can download it on iTunes. You can play it to your heart's content over and over again. We strongly recommend you do so, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
At Sunday's show, we're going to be talking about Robert Altman and his extraordinary career, and then we'll cover some other topics as well, but that's a good one to look forward to. And then we're going to be looking into the classic Psycho in the weeks ahead as well. And we have our movie song of the week, actually. The one last show was horror movie.
Cooper, right?
Alice Cooper, he's back.
Yeah, and
the man behind
the mask. That didn't sound really great at all from what I remember when I was my sophomore year in high school. I remember being a lot catchier.
You know what? You want to know something embarrassing? I actually still have the original 45 of that song.
Wow.
Right here. Yeah. I bought it when I was a teenager. And that's, of course, from Friday the 13th, part 68.
Yeah.
And we'll be having another horror-themed song at the end of this show. In a way, peripherally. It's a hard word to say. It's a related to horror. But it's a great song, actually.
Okay, sounds good.
So that'll be at the end of the show. I need to say something. Send a message out to one of our great friends and loyal listeners, Patrick. His birthday is today.
Happy birthday, Patrick.
Yes, happy birthday, Patrick. He's a great guy. And we talked to him for the first time. I've been in correspondence with him for years now and just got to talk to him for the first time last week. So.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Now, what's going on with you? You seen anything new that we haven't been speaking about?
Well, before I do anything, before I really just go off and start spouting at the mouth, which I'm really good at, there are a couple of films I need to mention, like local films and just a couple of films, horror films, that just since we are in that that time of the year. There are a couple of great local films that were made over the last couple of years that I've seen and talked about on the show, and I just want to remind people about them. Paul Bassetti's Cannibal Cheerleader Camp, Chris Kiros and the guys who made Zomthology, Lonnie Martin's Women's Studies, and then Gary Ugarit's Deadlands films, and these are all, like, great indie-made horror films from around here, and they are available on DVD or will be available on DVD through, like, Amazon or Netflix. And I strongly recommend them. But the one I really want to push is actually a movie by Zach Parker called Clinch that I saw a couple months ago. And he's a good friend of the show. He's always supported us, especially he gave us raves about the Polanski show. And I saw this movie a couple weeks ago, and it is very Lynchian. It's very much like Race with the Devil. And it's a really cool horror film. And you can get it from Netflix. You can buy it from Amazon. And it's really good. I can't describe it because it's one of those films you just got to really see for yourself. But it's really well done. And I strongly recommend all these films.
Speaking of praise, did you see Keith's write-up about Polanski today on The House Next Door?
No, I didn't. I haven't gotten there yet.
Well, he raved about you, my friend.
He raved about me?
Yes.
Jesus Christ, why am I the last to know about this? I'm getting my ass kicked in a boxing class tonight. Why don't I know about this stuff?
Oh, it was posted at 3:15 this morning.
3:15 in the morning?
Yeah, you weren't boxing then, so.
No, but I was sleeping probably and having nightmares, so. All right, I'm going to go find this. Okay.
Yeah, you need to look that up.
Oh, my God.
Al Martino died, man.
No.
Yeah, to which the first thought I had was he was alive, but
okay.
he is Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather. He passed away.
You can act like a man. Well, he can go ahead and he's going to the big sausage thing in the sky, man. Oh my god. Yeah, that's great. That great line they have in part three. Where he says, "Hey, Mike, I'm playing your favorite song." He goes, "I'm gonna go make a sausage sandwich."
Yeah, he was great. You know, and here's some news about Al Pacino. Speaking of The Godfather, have you read this? Al Pacino was a whore.
What? wait. All right, you gotta explain that. Give me some context.
Yeah, I will explain it. Apparently, when Al Pacino was 20. He lived in Sicily, which was a shock to me. I thought I knew his family had come from, his descendants had come from Sicily, but I thought the first time he visited Sicily was Godfather 2. But apparently, he lived in Sicily for a time when he was 20, and he had to make ends meet. So he gave favors to a certain wealthy woman that took care of him, which is in itself a form of prostitution. So the headline has been from this revelation, and it comes from the New York Post, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, was that Al Pacino was a whore.
Wow.
Okay.
I just don't.
How is it, though, how is it that if you hear that about a man, especially someone as cool as Al Pacino, you brush it off. Or you think, it makes him a little cooler. But say if it was Tuesday Weld at that time. How image damaging would that be? That's a question.
You mean to him now or back then?
I'm saying if it were a woman.
Oh, it was a woman. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Oh, dude, unfortunately, the way our society works, it may be very damaging. Sadly.
Yeah.
Very. Like, we're just, yeah, I mean... I mean, that's just unfortunately the way our society works.
We're gonna bring on Richard Marvin in a little bit. He's a film composer. He's collaborated amongst other directors, of course. He's collaborated with director Jonathan Mostow on four different occasions. Mostow, of course, is the director of movies like Breakdown, terrific movie.
Awesome movie, U-571, T3, and the latest one, right?
Surrogates, yeah.
Surrogates,
we're going to... premiere a track from Surrogates during his interview, too, from his score. It's an interesting score, 120-piece orchestra with electronica thrown in.
Wow.
Interesting. What else is new on the film front?
What else is new? I guess the big story of the week, I guess, for a lot of us is the Where the Wild Things Are, which I'm really looking forward to. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that I had seen a movie... but I didn't really get a chance to talk about it. I had some audio interference, you could say, because of someone we had on the show. So I didn't really want to, talk above him. So I do want to talk about it now, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay, Jane Campion's Bright Star.
Right.
And we talked about it a little bit. But I've really been thinking about this film a lot because I was watching other older films that are not really that related to it, but... the more I think about it, the more blown away I am by it. And this is, of course, about Keats, played by Ben Whishaw, who, once again, I say he played Bob Dylan, and now he's played Keats. So this guy's played two magnificent poets. But it's really Abbie Cornish, who is the love interest in the film, and she's fantastic. I definitely think there's a Best Actress nomination here. I would be surprised if it's not. But what I'm really pushing for, more than anything else with this film... is the Best Supporting Actor nomination for Paul Schneider. And he seems like he's the lone American in the film, and people will know him, obviously. I believe he's in Parks and Recreation, if I'm not mistaken. But also, he was the older brother in Lars and the Real Girl, who gives probably the most important speech in the movie to Lars about what it means to be a man. Probably one of those like great scenes that never gets its due. And he was also in All the Real Girls, where he also wrote the script. And he's like one of these guys who should have made it a long time ago because he's got like leading man charisma all over the place. But he's just great in a supporting role, I guess you could say, as Keith's mentor. I don't remember his name off the top of my head in the film, but I obviously think that Campion must have watched All the Real Girls and thought, wow, we need to put him in here. Because the character's kind of in some ways similar, but it's just a beautiful-looking movie. Just a beautiful movie. And like I said, it doesn't hit you all at once, but when it does, it's powerful. And I got to say, it really turning out to be one of the better films I've seen this year.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm watching it, and I really like the first half a lot, but then there's this charge, you say it meanders, but I do think it's one of Jane Campion's better post-piano films, because I really haven't been impressed with, even though I guess you could say the most interesting thing about was Holy Smoke with Kate Winslet, I still didn't think that was... God, it's been like 10 years, I think, since I've seen that. But that wasn't as good as I thought it could be. And A Portrait of a Lady I wasn't crazy about. And In the Cut, I don't know. Could anyone follow that movie? I couldn't. I remember seeing that in the theater. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me. But I got to give kudos to Meg Ryan for trying something new.
Yeah.
That's for sure. And that movie does have a cult following, believe it or not. But no,
I'm sure.
Like,
you know, a movie like Holy Smoke is kind of built for a cult following.
That one does have a. But this is, I think, the most really well-rounded, tightest films he's made since The Piano.
Yeah,
and it's actually it is a really decent film, and I hope it gets some notice at the end of the year.
Well, I hope it does too. You know, unfortunately, with those kinds of movies, it all depends upon the campaign, whether or not they choose the campaign
and it's
for
it. Tight. I was thinking about the best actress is going to be very interesting, because I do think it could be Cornish. It's definitely going to be Meryl Streep for one of these movies, if not both. I think there's a possibility, because I'm sure she's just great and it's complicated as well.
Yeah.
She probably walks away with that movie too, but I think she's a shoo-in. I think this Carey Mulligan for this My Education, I haven't read a bad thing yet about this film.
Yeah.
So I think that's another one to watch.
What's the other one that Meryl Streep is in?
Oh, no, Julie and Julia.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, I know, but, you know, you got that. And, you know, there are a couple others, but, I mean, it's going to be, when we come to the end of the year, I think Nine, there's probably going to be a lot of, they're going to push for a lot of the actresses in Nine, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure about that.
Well, I think Nine will actually be the movie to that and Up in the Air.
Up in the Air is definitely going to be the one to beat if the reviews are any indication so far. I mean, I haven't read a bad thing about that either. But, those are just some of the things that I wanted to talk about.
Yeah. All right, let's get to our interview, and then we'll get to our song of the show. Song of the South.
Yeah.
and I apologize. Apparently, I had... This is fascinating. I had change in my pocket that was clanging loudly in my dryer at the start of the show, and I think it really threw some people off.
Wow, really?
Yeah. So I just want to apologize for that.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
Yeah, yeah. See, real life happens when I'm doing the show. You know, I actually live in an environment where some life happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to know.
Right.
I don't live in a bubble like you do, Jerry.
I don't. I don't think anyone has ever accused you of living in a bubble.
All right. Here is Richard Marvin, a great talent, speaking about his philosophies on film composition, how he got started in the business, and his collaborations with director Jonathan Mostow, including the latest one, Surrogates. And this is the fourth time you've worked with Jonathan, correct? Fourth collaboration?
Yeah, we have a long-standing relationship. I think we go back 17 years or so, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So how did you guys meet? Was it Breakdown was the first project?
No, I was a studio musician in the 80s, and I think it was a friend of mine was the production designer on a direct-to-video movie called Flight of Black Angel. Mm-hmm. That was Jonathan's first movie. I think it was 91 or 92, and my friend gave Jonathan a demo of some of the stuff I've been working on as trying to break into being a composer. And Jonathan responded to it, and we did that first movie together and had a small orchestra for that, and which led on to several years later to Breakdown and U571 and then Surrogates.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think clicked between the two of you? Because obviously it's been a very productive collaboration you guys have had.
Well, according to Jonathan, what he really likes is how I deal with tension and tension music, and also music that's driving and creating an action feel where people are sort of at their end of the ropes, and they're sort of frantic. And he likes the way that I score those kind of scenes, whether it's a bank scene in Breakdown or a chase scene in Surrogates. For example, Surrogates, he called me and said, "This is right up your alley. This is what you do. This is what you do so well." And we have developed a certain understanding of how he likes things to be scored over the years.
Mm-hmm. Is there kind of a how present is he in the when you're putting it all together? Is he a very present director?
Yeah, he's very hands-on. He's hands-on with every department of making a film. In this case, with Surrogates, we started several months earlier, and he asked me to just work on piano alone and just come up with some themes and concepts for the movie and not do it to picture and just sort of improvise and come up with some things and some ideas. And he came over for a couple times and listened to my ideas and really liked them. And after that process, I went over to the computer and keyboard and started simulating orchestra with some of the themes that I'd come up with piano and putting it to picture. And it was really one of the most straight-ahead and productive kind of way of working with him. There was I was on the right wavelength with him from the very beginning, which isn't always the case, but this was a pretty straightforward process with Surrogates.
Yeah, and so you started picking out themes and different ideas based on the script alone?
Yes.
Is that something that you like to do, or...?
Let me correct that. I also had dailies and rough cuts of the movie at that point. So I'd seen the movie in a rough state, and then okay. I would be improvising without having the picture up in front of me and playing along, which is how I usually compose, which is how I get ideas, is watching the movie and just sort of improvising into a computer. But he wanted me to not do it visually, not to have anything up in front of me, just be thinking more of thematically what kind of approach were we going to take.
Well, speaking of those approaches and the different sounds that you've given to his films, they're all very thrilling, action-driven projects, but what unique voice did you aim to give each of these projects? How do they differ for you?
The first one, Flight of Black Angel and Breakdown, were very similar. I think this is John's forte. It's the kind of movie where you have a very sort of everyday person who is stuck in this extraordinary situation where he's just out of his wits in terror. In Breakdown, it was Kurt Russell who, just as a quick synopsis, who broke down in the middle of the desert and his wife got into a truck to go get some help, and then she disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just an everyday man who was just beyond his wits' ends trying to find her. And that was a lot of that score was that kind of music, which was, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm out of my mind. And that was which led to U571, which was really sort of different in that this was all about being in a submarine and the claustrophobic tension and terror
mm-hmm.
of being in a submarine under the water that's maybe not going to make it back up. It's getting deeper and deeper. It's lost all power. In combination with some real sort of old-fashioned, big, melodic fanfare kind of cues. And then going to Surrogates, of course, which was a little more, well, certainly futuristic, more modern sounding score with lots of percussion, lots of very rhythmic orchestral kind of writing that was helping to signify the mechanical nature of the world that Bruce Willis was living in.
Understand that on top of the electronic elements in this score for Surrogates, you were working with a lot of musicians, something like 120 musicians, if I read correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. We did a really different approach this time. We did a modular kind of recording process where all the EQs had been, I had mocked them up with electronic simulation of orchestra and percussion, and everything was pretty well done. And even in the previewing process, those cues were put into the movie early on, so about 40% of the movie had been scored before we even got down to the business of putting it with orchestra. So once we came to orchestra, we had a lot of passages that are known as sort of as ostinatos, which are repetitive kind of figures that go under and sort of bubble under the surface as big action cues go on. So we had a session to just play that part, and then we had another session with the original session was about 35-6 people, and then we'd have another 60 come in the afternoon, and we'd do all the big chords and the big melodies. Mm-hmm. And then in the evening was the brass section, which was a 20-piece brass session, and they would overdub on top of what would be done during the day. So, you know, it was about 120 people when you add all that up together.
Isn't it important, though, for maybe less so for an action film, I'm not sure, but as much as where to place music, isn't it just as important to where not to place it, when not to have music? Is that a hard thing to gauge at times?
Well, I'm a big advocate of only putting music where it's needed, and I'm not in favor of this wallpaper approach to the music being there all the time, because
mm-hmm.
I really, and John is also feels the same way, especially in really tense scenes where it's certainly the case that less is more sometimes. And sometimes if you put music on those kind of scenes, you're telling the audience that, oh, this is scary, this is tense. And
right.
If it's already working, sometimes the natural sound keeps the picture real, keeps it sort of realistic, and you wait for your moment where you just add that next layer by adding music that really makes a statement instead of just being wallpaper behind and dictating to the audience, this is how you're supposed to feel right now.
Yeah, and that's always a danger to dictate that to them through music. So how do you define the job of a composer?
Well, hopefully you are enhancing what is already on the screen. Hopefully you're in a project where you're not trying to make something seem that it's not quite working on the screen, which unfortunately, and that's part of our job sometimes, is to help scenes that didn't quite come off, and we need to make them seem a little more something.
Mm-hmm.
But in a perfect world, I think there's a level of feeling as an audience member that can only be achieved by music, because it's not verbal, it's not it's another dimension of feeling that hopefully as a composer you're adding that little spice on top of the scene that makes people feel a little more whatever it is, whether it's sad, whether it's melancholy, whether it's scared, whether it's terrified, whether, you know, any of those emotions.
Yeah.
I really try to enhance the scenes rather than come down with the sledgehammer and say, this is how you're supposed to feel.
When you watch films as a youngster, what films were you drawn to, and were you always conscious of the scores for those films?
Well, it's a little embarrassing to say, but I'm not like Danny Elfman or some of these other composers who've always been film score nuts. I never really noticed films or music in films until I was in my early 20s. And up to that point, I've been playing jazz and wanting to be a jazz pianist. And at that point, was in Indiana University and just totally shedding every day on piano. And not until I got out to L.A. and started becoming a studio player did I even notice the music, frankly, in TV and movies.
Yeah.
I really wasn't I'm not a student of the art until I was a little later in life. And then when I was working in the 80s, I got the opportunity to work with some of the greats like David Newman, Tom Newman, Marie Schar, John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, all the James Horner, all the A-list composers. I was the synthesizer player on all those sessions in the 80s, which really opened my eyes to the whole process and the whole art of film scoring. And that's when I got bitten with the bug of wanting to do it.
Mm. When you watched all of those composers, when you observed them, when you're working with them, did they have similar traits, and how were they unique as well?
Well, I think certainly John Williams is unique in his use of leitmotifs or little melodic phrases or sometimes big melodic phrases that are just, he's in a class of his own, I believe, in his melodic statements. They're things that we all know have become iconic with him and things that we are part of our culture. People like Tom Newman and Marie Schar, I learned a lot about how minimal music and very emotional music can enhance a story and make you feel for the characters in a way that without the music you just don't quite get to that level. And they both had quite extensive use of electronics in their scores in the 80s, and it was a great learning experience for me being a keyboard player to learn how they used electronics and percussion to create some of the most, I think, original kind of scores to date. Certainly Tom Newman has created a unique style that made a huge impact on film scoring.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting that you brought up your love of jazz, because so many composers that we talk to, I remember Mark Isham talking about this, he came from a big jazz background, and it's true with a lot of composers. Do you find that that's very helpful to you as a composer of films, that background?
It really, I don't think I'd be a film composer unless I were a jazz player, because really what I do is I play jazz, but I do it, I don't use the traditional swing rhythms, but I improvise to picture. I'm like the old guy in the 20s watching a movie playing organ and playing along, and I'm underscoring what I'm seeing and what I'm feeling, but I'm really improvising. That's my whole process, is watch the movie and play along and find something, some melody, some feel, some texture that I'm intuitively feeling as I'm watching. And that's the basis of my whole approach to film scoring.
Yeah.
Is improvising. And if you think of, if you studied Mozart or Beethoven, they were great improvisers as well. And so I think it's, you know, there's a tradition of improvising that's really part of the creative process in music, and certainly part of film scoring, I believe.
Is it a different kind of process when you're doing television work?
Well, it is, because I just don't have the time to spend. I go to the devices and things that I know work, and I'm less creative, because I need to get things, a lot of music out per week. I probably do 30 minutes of music a week for my series, and I don't have time to really worry about finding that perfect synth sound that's going to work on this cue. I need to put out 7-8 minutes of music a day, so I go to things that are comfortable, and hopefully I expand the palette as I'm working. The advantage of being on television for so long is that I've become very quick, very fast writer. So
yeah,
Surrogates was quite a luxury to have 3 months to write, I think, 70 minutes of music.
Is there a dream project, a dream genre that you'd like to compose for?
It's a good question. I've been talking to my agents lately, and I have been in the TV world for the last 5-6 years doing a lot of dramas,
mm-hmm.
6 Feet Under or In Treatment, and I'd really like to get back to doing more thriller action movies. It's something I haven't done in a long time, and so Surrogates was a great chance to get back to that. What I think was what I originally started with in the early 90s with Mostow. It's something I'd like to do more of. I'd also love to do some animation. I've never done animation. I think it would be in some respects, that's the epitome of film music, I think, is doing animation, and it's something that I've never done, so I would love to do that as well.
And I know you've done some lighter-hearted films. Is composing a comedy particularly difficult?
I think it's probably the hardest thing to do.
Because
how do you write funny music? You know, you can have a slide trombone and a kazoo, but you know, funny music is really, really difficult to do.
Yeah.
I'm sort of intimidated by, frankly, doing comedies. I did one with Ray Romano called Eulogy, and that was one of the hardest things I've ever done, is try to come up with music that enhances comedy but isn't trying to be funny. So
I would think that would be really a big challenge for comedies, not to be too on the nose with it.
Yeah, I think Dave Newman is great at that. Debney's great at that. I really respect those guys who do comedies, light comedies. It's a real art.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, sir, for taking time out. I really enjoyed this score very much.
Oh, I really appreciate it, Jamie.
Richard Marvin, the score is from Surrogates, the Jonathan Mostow film, which is still in theaters. Candidates for the best score of the year so far, Jerry, what do you think?
Candidates for the best score. It's very interesting because it's been more, you got to help me out here, because a lot of the soundtracks I've bought actually are much more like other songs, pop songs
and
stuff.
Right.
Hey, now let's think. This is a really good question, because Star Trek and Up, I would definitely have to put as great score.
Right. I think those are probably certainly Up is a shoe-in for best score. But it's funny, because out of all the reviews that I've read throughout the year, the one film that they mention the score of most often is The Informant. And I know that it's partially because it's Marvin Hamlisch's return to scoring films.
Yeah, no, that's another good choice, actually. And that's a film we really haven't talked about that much on the show, and we should at some point talk about.
We'll save it for the DVD release next week.
Yeah. it didn't really make a splash, that movie. It didn't.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's a great trailer. I mean, it's very funny. And once you really get it, once the movie really gets going, and you do have to give it a while, but once it gets going, there's another, I wouldn't be surprised if Matt Damon doesn't pick up a Best Actor nod somewhere in one of these awards things, because it's quite a performance.
Here's some news about Polanski.
Okay, cool. Let's hear it.
He is working on finishing The Ghost from jail. The Ghost is his latest movie that's currently in post-production
right.
at the time that he was arrested.
How is
Screen,
he able to do that? I mean,
screenwriter says that he's working with giving notes and things from jail.
Okay, all right. I'm sure there's got to be some people out there that are up in arms about that, but...
Yeah, it's interesting.
But I think it's good because, I mean, he's just going to go nuts otherwise. I mean, he's already, we know from the last show we talked, he was very depressed. So I'm not going to make, I'm not going to say anything else. I was going to say something. Go to trouble. So I'm just going to let him finish the film, okay?
Yeah, he made it. So let him give his notes and everything on how it should be finished.
Let him get it done.
Here's something about the film, though. Will it suffer because of his arrest and current publicity? Or will it do better than it would have otherwise? Because any publicity
better.
Is good publicity.
Yeah, I think it would do better, but in having said that, they really need to let him finish the film so it comes out soon. Because if it's one of these things that, you know, we're talking like, even I think if you wait like a year and a half, that's all, the way our society works now in the 24-hour news cycle, this is going to be old news. So they got to let him finish it and get this thing done.
So they need to capitalize on this arrest, is what you're saying.
I know that sounds horrible and everything, but that's just the way the world works.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, and I don't doubt a studio would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How far along are they, though, that...
You know, I don't know. I know that he was already deep into editing. So however long that process is for him, I know Scorsese takes a year to edit a film. Polanski might take 3 months. I don't know.
What,
I don't know what his thing is.
Speaking of Scorsese, bumping that movie to February of next year really just changed the whole entire outlook of the Oscars. I mean, really just changed everything.
Yeah, it changed my movie going year. That was
one
of the five or six movies I was going to go see this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And what was the rationale? And I'm not sure I understand what the rationale was.
The rationale was up in the air. The rationale was the economy. We only have so much money to spend on Academy marketing campaigns,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to put all their eggs in the up-in-the-air basket.
Wow. That's still a big risk, though. You know, that's not a sure thing.
My argument was it's a Scorsese film. First of all, it's a Scorsese thriller.
Yeah.
Typically a genre that isn't recognized very much at Oscar time,
mm-hmm.
but it has Scorsese's name behind it.
Yeah.
That's the only campaign you need is Scorsese
mm-hmm.
above the title.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to spend millions wooing people to pay attention to a Scorsese movie.
Yeah, it's not like, hey, we got this director here. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, you know, Scorsese. So,
yeah.
No, you really don't need to. I don't get it. It's like William Goldman said, no one knows anything. So
you remember he's the guy that you blew off like 12 times in the past when he should have won and then gave it to him for his B-movie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy.
Yeah, that guy, yeah. The one where
another
he
one,
win because Lucas, Coppola, and Spielberg came out to give the award.
I said that to Chris the other night. I said, you know, there's some instances where you know who's going to get the award before they get it. Not because of any kind of prediction quality that you have.
Yeah.
It's because exactly what you said.
Yeah.
You know, Coppola and Spielberg and Lucas come out to present Scorsese with the Best Director Oscar.
Yeah,
I mean,
give it to whoever else is nominated.
yeah. It's like, and it made sense when Polanski won because Harrison Ford came out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He didn't come out as in being gay. He came out and actually presented the award to nobody because Polanski couldn't attend. But it's interesting because another guy that deserved to win many Oscars was Altman, and I've been watching a lot of stuff lately on him, and he won the honorary Oscar, and that was the time that he revealed that he had a full heart transplant. This
right.
was 2003, I think.
Right.
6 years ago. It doesn't seem like 6 years ago. But...
I know.
And we will be talking about that amazing body of work for Mr. Altman on Sunday.
There you go, yeah.
So he's back, Man Behind the Mask from Alice Cooper was our song last show.
I just remember it being a lot more catchy or a lot heavier, and I just was listening to it. Maybe it was just my like the cell phone connection or whatever. But I was like, that's a really wimpy song.
It's terrible. It's the dumbest lyrics you've ever heard. Hang on. Yeah, and the funny thing is,
and I love Alice Cooper, but I was just like, this doesn't sound like what I thought it was, remembered it at all.
The funny thing is, I have not been able to stop singing it all week since we played it.
Okay.
And it's that lyric. You're deep in love, but you're deeper in the woods for some reason.
That's always what I think of.
Yeah. Let's play a little flashback here. I mean, this is just too good. It's like Disco Voorhees or something.
Yeah.
What was Alice Cooper's hits? Did he had hits?
Okay,
right.
But I saw Alice Cooper perform in the Tower Records parking lot.
The parking lot?
Yeah. No, I'm not making this up. Really,
did he have like a hat at his feet or something for change or donation?
It sounds that way, doesn't it? So this is Tower Records in Rockville, 1991, and he performed they made a little stage. And he performed in a parking lot. It was surreal. It was just really crazy.
Wow. Where's he now?
He after that, though, he was in Wayne's World, and,
I repeat, where is he now?
Okay, I don't know where he is now. I can't give you that answer. I'm sorry.
Investigate that, Jerry.
Okay, yeah.
Whatever happened to Alice Cooper, that'll be our next theme show.
He was on the Muppets. I remember he was on the Muppet Show one time when I was growing up. Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing how that show was thought of as being good for kids, and they brought on people like Alice Cooper.
Oh, Alice Cooper's harmless.
I think Ozzy Osbourne came on and he bit the head off of Kermit. Wasn't that?
Now there's a show I keep thinking about, the Osbournes. You know, that was a fun show. I never thought I'd live to see the day that the Osbournes would be like such a big show.
Right. Yeah, we have a question in the chat room. Anyone see the movie Dead Time Stories?
No.
I've heard of it. I could see the video cover box in my mind. I haven't seen it. Sorry, dude.
Sorry, man. We haven't seen it, but it's got to be. It's that time of year. I wouldn't mind watching it.
Yeah. Silent Night, Deadly Night. Is there a movement around Christmas time where people actually pull out Silent Night, Deadly Night and watch it?
I think that and both versions of Black Christmas.
Yeah.
I think
so. It's like if you're a sicko, you watch that instead of Christmas Vacation.
Well, yeah, I don't even think you know those movies. Isn't Billy Bob Thornton in one of the Silent Night?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
Those movies. I mean, I'm surprised that. I think that's getting remade too, though. Silent Night, Deadly Night, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh well, it better be. That makes perfect sense. Anyway, all right. So we'll be back on Sunday night. We'll have a great show then talking about Altman. Thank you all for joining us tonight. If you missed any portion of the program and you just can't do without it, you can replay this show anytime. Okay, song of the show. You ready?
Okay, let's do it.
This song is a classic, really, and it's been used in several films. Most memorably for me, in an unmemorable, otherwise, film, horror film of the 1980s. So the big challenge is not what the song is, it's what movie am I referring to?
Oh, God.
Yes. Okay. All right, Jerry. I'm going to hold you to the fire next week. See if you can come up with a movie.
Oh, shit.
All right, buddy. I'll see you Sunday night.
All right, see you Sunday, man. Good night, everyone.
Bye, guys. Song will begin any moment now.
Yeah, I was going to say, man.
What a great time for my computer to crap out. All this build-up. Okay. La-di-da. I've got the little hourglass. It's like my computer stuck when I try to press play on this song. Give it a second. I'm sorry, everybody. First, my clanging laundry. And now, okay, here we go. Dear God. I promise it's starting right now.
Yeah.